You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Is the transmission of trauma multigenerational? We look at what social and behavioral factors result in trauma in successive generations.
And first, what causes the kind of radical militancy behind suicide bombings and other deadly violence on civilians? It's a question that many social scientists have studied. But our next guest, a former federal prosecutor, decided to find out his own way by asking them directly. Ken Ballen interviewed scores of so-called terrorists and found their reason for killing surprising. His book, Terrorists in Love, profiles six of their stories. Welcome, Ken Ballen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Maria.
It's great to have you with us. I think before we talk about the substantive interviews in your book, I wanted to inquire about your realizations in your prosecutorial life. You talked about some of your experiences in interrogation, terrorists, killers, child molesters, and you said you had to put yourself in their shoes. What can you tell us about this dynamic?
You have to be able to communicate with them. By putting yourself in their shoes, it's not that you ever approve of what they've done or that you're ever really empathizing with them. You keep your distance from them in a certain way, but you also have to not pass judgment so that you're able to elicit from them their confessions. And then part of your job as a prosecutor, and this was certainly true with the terrorists that I interviewed for this book, was to corroborate as much as possible everything these people told you. So it's not a matter of sitting down there and just listening to them. It's a matter of having the skills of an experienced interrogator. I've done this for some two decades, and then being able to corroborate it.
You actually used the word empathy. Did you really have empathy and developing a human bond with your nemeses?
Yes. With some of them, I was able to connect whatever horrendous actions they've taken. They're still human beings, and it's important to connect with that part of them in order that they feel comfortable confessing and divulging their true stories.
You said that in one case, you got a son to wire his father. How do you get a son to wire his father for you?
This is not as unusual as it seems. This is part of your job as a prosecutor and investigator. You develop confidence in people, and sometimes you're able to give them some benefits for cooperating with you.
And then the other thing that I was struck by was how you were talking about torture and how it really does not produce any truth.
I can tell you that my experience as a prosecutor and as an investigator and interrogator and the experience of the FBI, torture is never used. Oftentimes what happens with torture is you get false information because people want to stop the torture and will say anything so that you stop the torture and actually are more inclined to tell you what you want to hear. There's the famous case, of course, of the terrorist who was sent to Egypt by the United States, tortured, and then said that there was weapons of mass destruction and cooperation between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And he later said, well, I said all of that to stop the torture because I knew that's what the Americans wanted me to say. So that's the danger in torture. You get information, but it's not necessarily reliable information. So therefore, you go down a false path oftentimes with torture.
I wonder if sometimes prosecution may be so frustrated or overzealous that they're sort of desperate for any direction and that torture emerges from that. Do you think that that ever does happen?
No, I don't. What happened after 9/11 was that the interrogation program was turned over to people who did not have experience in interrogations, believe it or not, who came up with this whole regime of torture. It was not left in the hands of the professionals. Like, for example, the FBI strenuously opposed the use of torture at Guantanamo and elsewhere, and this whole program was taken away from them.
You went and interviewed several people who attempted to, in many cases, blow themselves up while fighting in a holy jihad. And one of the places that you went in Saudi Arabia was this prison that was a rehabilitation prison. I'm going to ask you to get into some of the interviews there, but what can you tell us about this, its setup, its intent, and who you met with there?
I interviewed several hundred people who were radicals and terrorists. About half of them did not open up to me because they would give me what rhetoric. It was like listening to an Osama bin Laden speech. I would say about a little over 100 or so I actually interviewed at length. And of those 100 that I interviewed, six individuals' stories were so compelling, changed everything I thought I knew as an expert, so-called expert in this area, that I felt I had to share those stories in this book. And those six stories comprise the core of the book. It's not an analytical book. It's a book telling true life stories of these individuals, their ancestry, their grandfather, their grandmother, their parents, how they became radicalized, what their culture was like, what led them to the radical cause, and as importantly, what led them away. So this was a product of 6 years of work and interviewing literally hundreds of people. I hadn't set out to write a book. I was in these countries overseas conducting research into public opinion and trying to figure out why people supported extremism. And as part of that research, would talk to radicals. And then these six individuals, their stories were so compelling and, as I said, changed everything I thought I knew that I felt I had to share them.
The first one that you talked about was this young man, Ahmed. He was in this Saudi rehabilitation prison. I think what was most striking was how much pain he had in his life prior to becoming radicalized.
Well, he did, and many of the individuals do. And I think that's something to keep in mind. I mean, they join the cause not simply from ideological commitment or religious fervor, but they also join from personal circumstances. Ahmad couldn't find work. He was a young man in Saudi Arabia. He was estranged from his father, which is a difficult situation in a very traditional patriarchal society. He went to Iraq because, in part, he saw the pictures at Abu Ghraib of, if you recall, the American Army prison where people were tortured. So he went to fight. He was a very idealistic young man. He thought he was doing the right thing, protecting his Muslim brothers. When he arrived in Iraq with 25 other young men from all over the Arab world, the Al-Qaeda leader exhorted them to suicide attack, because telling them this is the most noble mission you could do. But nobody volunteered for that. As Ahmad told me, you know, I went there to fight for my Muslim brothers, and yes, I knew if I was killed, I'd go to heaven, but I was in no hurry to get there, and I wanted to do some good on earth first. Anyway, what happened is when he went to Iraq, he was kept 4 months basically in isolation, not trained on any weapon, kept in boredom, allowed to pray, but do very little else. And he was desperate to do anything. Finally, he went on a mission with some other Iraqi jihadis, and he was driving a tanker truck. And about 1,000 yards before a concrete barrier, the Iraqi jihadis jump out of the tanker truck. He has to drive it because otherwise it would go out of control. And within literally less than 20 seconds, the truck is remotely detonated. It contained 26 tons of liquid explosives. It kills 8 people on the spot and countless scores were injured, including Ahmad, who miraculously survived but had serious burns throughout his body, lost most of his fingers and toes. His face was completely disfigured. And then he was taken to Abu Ghraib, of all places. He was petrified because this is what caused him to go, this in part. So he was petrified, what's going to happen to me? Instead, he was given 30 operations by the American doctors, skin transplants, cellulite infusions. He was patiently and carefully nursed back to health, talked how to walk again, how to talk again. Most of all, he met an American Army medic who was tremendous with him, and it was the first woman he had ever met outside his own family, which is extraordinary for us. You know, he became fiercely pro-American in his heart as a result of this experience. He said to me, my Muslim brothers who I went to fight for treated me like a piece of rotten meat. The Americans who I went to fight against treated me with kindness and respect.
What had led him down the path in the first place sounded like he really felt bad about himself. He had an abusive father. He didn't have a lot of friends, and he felt he had sinned, and he wanted to sort of redeem himself.
Well, that's part of it. Young people join a cause because they want to feel a greater meaning in their lives. And then when he got there, he saw that that the greater meaning was not what he thought it was. And this is a common experience among many of them, and many of them are manipulated by their leaders into committing suicide attacks and are lied to, and while their leaders are busy stealing money, and they use these young men as cannon fodders. In this sense, Ahmad's story is not unique.
Another one that really stood out for me was the one you called the jihadi Romeo and Juliet, Abby and Miriam, who are in love but can't be together, and they are both suicidal, really, for personal reasons. Tell us about these two and what leads them down the radical path.
They're like very much like a Romeo and Juliet. They fall madly in love as teenagers and even serenade each other from open windows. as the Shakespearean couple once did. But this is not Shakespeare, and in Saudi Arabia, the young man Abdullah needed a dowry or bride price to marry his love. He didn't have the money. He had $8,000. The going bride price was $20,000. So Miriam's father marries her off against her will to a man three times her age. So he's in his 60s as a fourth wife. He's got $30,000, so he can marry her. She actually rebels against this, at least symbolically commits suicide. Abdullah thinks he should commit suicide, but he knows that that's a great sin. So he thinks that he should go and fight in holy war, because if he dies in holy war, then he goes to heaven. And in heaven, he can marry whomever he wants to, including the love of his life, Miriam. So it's a kind of a tragic story, again, like Romeo and Juliet. This is not Shakespeare. It's real life, and real life in Saudi Arabia in the 20th and 21st century.
You noted that a number of your interviewees eventually saw that Al-Qaeda was really leading vulnerable people into a path of violence and hate, but it was not across the board that people saw that.
And it's also the Taliban. Half the people portrayed of the six were involved with Al-Qaeda. The other half were involved with the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And some saw the light, but one interview I did was of a man by the name of Malik. Malik rose to quite a privileged position inside the Taliban. He would interpret dreams for the leader of the Taliban, Mullah Omar, and Mullah Omar would decide battle strategy, believe it or not, on the basis of these dreams and visions that he and this fellow Malik had. Anyway, though, Malik in time saw the corruption of the Taliban, the theft of oil, the manipulation and the lies of the leaders. So he became disillusioned with the Taliban, and I was in the interview with him and thinking to myself, wow, this is another guy like Ahmad who goes through this experience and sees the corruption and goes away. And he reaches out towards the end of the interview, we've been talking for quite a long time, and to hold my hand in friendship, which is quite an extraordinary thing. Now, your listeners have to remember, these hundreds of people had never met an American before, except for Ahmad, never met a Jew before, and I happen to be Jewish. He takes my hand in friendship, and he says to me that the day of judgment will not come until every Jew is killed, saying of the prophet, he is telling me, and he is telling me that if the Jew, the prophet said, is hiding behind a rock, the rock itself will cry out, O Muslim, kill the Jew that is hiding behind me, and if the Jew is hiding behind the tree will cry out. And so at that point, I was ready for the interview to end, as you can well imagine. But while he became disillusioned with the corruption, he became more radicalized and joined an even more radical Taliban cell inside Pakistan, responsible for numerous terrorist acts. So not everybody who experiences this from the inside leaves the cause.
What were the common themes that you think social scientists and people who want to understand this, what did you find that people can take away?
Every time people read these stories, they come away with so much. I can't tell you the reaction I get, including from American intelligence officials, to actually read the stories and hear these people's words and thoughts from their own point of view. It just gives you a very different perspective on what's really going on and what these people are really thinking. And there's hope. I mean, I mentioned that last story of the guy who became even more radicalized. But there's another story in the book of a guy by the name of Shahid who was in a Taliban cell ultimately responsible for bombing the Marriott Hotel. So these guys are very hardcore. In any event, he was so struck by a dream that I had, because the importance of dreams and their belief system and culture cannot be underestimated, but he was so struck that I had what he interpreted as a religious vision, that he saw me for the first time not as the hated enemy, the hated American, but as a fellow human being. And he then left the violence of the Taliban. He joined a very fundamentalist sect, and he renounced the violence. So the hope here, just like Ahmad meeting the American Army nurse, the hope here is tangible. I felt it. I felt it with the human bonds that I was able to make with some of these people, despite who they were. You asked a little bit about this at the beginning. But that it can be transformative if we reach out. So there's a lot of hope in these stories.
Right. You mentioned actually three. You said Shahid, Ahmad, but also Kamal. Tell us about Kamal. You said he is also hope.
Absolutely. I mean, Kamal grew up as part of the royal family in Saudi Arabia. More importantly, even than the royal family, he's part of the religious branch of the royal family, who people in that country follow and have a very strict puritanical interpretation. And I met his father, who believes that Jews are doomed and going to hell. And Kamal went through a transition, and I think we don't have the time for me to describe it, but went through a transition where he left that kind of belief to believing that heaven is available for anyone, and that not just restricted to Muslims. And this was a remarkable transformation in a young man who grew up with the strictest and most narrow of interpretations.
The other thing about Kamal in particular from your book is that he really helped you to understand how much American policies were really fueling radicalism. What policies were the most important to Kamal and to others?
Actually, I think that he led me to see that really, as he said to me, is America sees itself as the center of everything that's happening in the world, but really the radicalism, in large part, is coming from within the Muslim world itself, and it's people like Kamal, and to a lesser extent, Ahmad and Shahid, who are changing that point of view, that it really comes less from American policy and more from their own world and their own perspective and their own beliefs. American policy, of course, influences things, but not what's controlling what's going on. But it shouldn't be seen as Kamal said, America is determining the course of everything, that a lot of this, the radicalism, comes from conflicts within their own societies. The message I get is, you know, lead by example. Don't try to impose your point of view, particularly by force of arms, on us. We admire America, but we admire America if it leads by example, not by force or not by telling us what to do. And that's the message you hear all over the world, no matter radical or not.
Ken Ballin is the author of Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals, a former federal prosecutor and the president and founder of Terror Free Tomorrow, a not-for-profit organization. Thank you so much, Ken Ballin.
When we come back, is trauma transmitted by survivors of atrocities to their offspring and generations to come? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Is the transmission of trauma multigenerational? Do children of survivors of mass atrocities have higher risk of developing psychological disorders? To understand the impact of multigenerational legacies of trauma, we look at the impact of survivors' post-trauma adaptational style in their children's eyes. Andrei Novak is clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine and the founding director of the Traumatic Stress Program. He is the author of Traumatic Stress in Human Behavior, Special Treatment Issues in Children of Holocaust Survivors, and Free Artistic Expression, a clinical exploration of resiliency and healing after trauma. Yael Danieli is director of the Group Project for Holocaust Survivors and Their Children. She's the founding co-president of the International Network of Holocaust and Genocide Survivors and Their Friends, and a founding director of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies. She's the author of publications including International Handbook of Multigenerational Legacies of Trauma, International Responses to Traumatic Stress, and research papers Multigenerational Legacies of Trauma, Modeling the What and How of Transmission and Differing Adaptational Styles in Families of Survivors of the Holocaust.
So let me welcome you both. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It is great to have you here on this very important subject. We have been discussing the concept of intergenerational trauma among us at the program for a while. And so we wanted to invite you both on here to talk about this idea of trauma being passed on from generation to generation. And what exactly is going on here? What does this mean, intergenerational trauma? What is it exactly? Yael Danieli, do you want to start on that?
Actually, we speak about intergenerational legacies of trauma. What we mean by that, the legacies, good and bad, it's not only bad, if that is at all a way to speak about it, but the legacies children grow up with as a result of having a particular way of adaptation of their parents to their traumatic legacies.
So what you're saying is that they may adopt a way of coping with life and life's traumas based on something their parents did when they were dealing with like a very severe trauma.
Parents have adapted to their trauma the best they could. They coped in different ways. As I described it in my writings and in our research, they've coped, for example, by adopting a style of remaining a victim, or a style of always fighting, or a style of being numb to the world. And the children grew up within homes that adapted those, what I call parents' adaptational styles, and they, for themselves, had to adapt to their own environments, their parents' history, and their own. I call what the children develop reparative adaptational impact. Adaptational, you understand, the children simply adapt to what they are brought into when they're brought into this world. And by reparative, I want to emphasize that the children's main mission in life, conscious or not, is to repair the parents and themselves from the trauma. That's the meaning of reparative. So in the children's adaptation to their own lives after trauma, after their parents' trauma, they develop reparative adaptational impacts of themselves. Now, impacts are very high intensity. If they take over their lives, the children suffer a great deal. If the impact, or if these reparative adaptational impacts are moderate or low, they may not experience their lives as full of suffering, and they may experience their lives as far less difficult than those whose impacts are high. I hope I'm not being too technical.
It's not too technical, but I think what might make it come alive is if you can give us an example.
A child, for example, who every task you propose says, I can't, I just can't. That means the child feels not up to meeting the world, and very often defeats themselves, even if they have all the capacities, but they don't have the feeling that they can. So they may lack in confidence. They may experience the world as a very threatening place, because perhaps the parent taught them that the world is a dangerous place and to watch out all the time.
And now this is not necessarily something that a parent would say. So where is it coming from?
First of all, the parents say it by telling stories. The parents also may behave like it. If every knock at the door becomes scary, and the child might just experience the parent's body, not just in words, but behaviors as well. The world is scary. The parents might very well say that. Actually, today people say that, even in this country, that it's scary to live here now. But even when it's in silence, the behavior very might convey that kind of fear, or it would be difficult for the parents to let the children separate, and the children in turn find it difficult to separate from the parents. These are some examples.
Specifically, because one of your papers talked about acquired vulnerability, so perhaps this links right in, Andrei Novak. How would you see this?
Just to understand where I'm coming from, in my earlier years, that's the time when I was working more with EIL2, I was very interested in the biological aspects of intergenerational transmission. That paper refers to some specific vulnerability to children of survivors. I was not the first one to report it. Zahava Solomon did before in Israel. So what we know, just to summarize a little bit, there are many, many aspects. So there's a whole spectrum what we would call intergenerational transmission. Like Yael said, the multi-generational legacy of transmission. I will focus first briefly on what we know about the biology of transmission and then focus a little bit about my current work on implicit memory or what is called non-declarative memory. So the early work, and it continues now to be done in different brands now, that study intergenerational transmission in families of sexually molested children and many other groups. Basically, there is a transplacental transmission through the placenta in mothers of a variety of chemicals, including the cortisol level. The cortisol level has been shown to be abnormal in mothers who were traumatized or come from traumatized background or have PTSD. Children down the line tend to be, during the first 2 years, overreact. So there seems to be a biological component to that. In addition, another biological component has been the behavioral epigenetics. So if you grow up with parents who continuously re-traumatize you because there's inconsistency, lack of support, there is fear, each knock on the door seems to be, like Yael said, there seems to be something happening in the body of the children, which now has been demonstrated that it shifts some of the effector genes. So that this is not a genetic change, but it is just the effector genes. And some of the protein in the body tend to be synthesized in different ways. And the person develops acquired response, abnormal or varied response to stress. And so somebody who grows up with parents who were survivors of some kind of major catastrophe and Holocaust and trauma or war may in time develop overreactivity, not only by acquiring their parents' behavior directly by observation, but also by developing some epigenetic changes. The adrenaline system tends to react. And this is believed to be a survival mechanism. It probably exists in animals.
I remember they actually tested some of this in mice, where they intentionally traumatized a mouse. Exactly. And even though its offspring was not traumatized, that the offspring, and I seem to remember that the offspring of the offspring also demonstrated PTSD and depression.
Exactly. A lot of work in mice, in rats. For instance, implicit trauma, where the rat was shocked only at birth and then left alone to be nurtured by the mother. And later in life, the same rat, because rats don't live long, so you can do this cycle very fast, you can evoke the shock without shocking, just a very mild shock. The traumatized at birth rats will overreact and will have a reaction that is abnormal compared to rats that were not shocked at birth. And then there are other studies done on monkeys. So we know that there is a biological component. But what Yael mentioned, the family component, is extremely important. Why is that so important? Because it is not only being exposed during your early life, in other words, 3, 4, 5, preschool and later.
Actually, our study has shown that the most influential behavior, parental behaviors, are the earlier ones. Yes. So that indeed could be not necessarily with words, but behavior.
Exactly, nonverbal. But there is even more so. Now there is the studies by DeCuspi, for instance, that show that in utero.
Yes, like you said, in the placenta, so it's understood. Placenta. Problem with that is that, for example, the placenta assumes the studies of the mothers, and we studied both mothers and fathers, and we see independent influences on the adaptation of the child.
Just to add to that is that besides the placental transmission, there seems to be a learning mechanism at the body level of the fetus that is independent of the placenta. No hormones, And that has been demonstrated by sending some stimulations, weak stimulations, through the mother's abdomen. And after a while, the fetus tends to recognize those stimulations. So that's very important, because what it tells us is that in certain mothers who are overreactive or are involved in more conflict at work, there is an additional, at work or at home, conflict with the spouses, there is an additional component, a learned component of reactivity, which is independent of the placenta. And then there is one more element which I have been more interested recently, and that is what is uploaded immediately after birth and during the first year or the first 3 years prior to the introduction of language. That means during the so-called childhood amnesia. During the first 3 years, most of people do not remember a lot from during the first 3 years of their life. But it seems that that is a very important period when nonverbal patterns of reactivity are being uploaded. And that is a universal mechanism. There's a lot of work there done, some of it by Tronick and Lachman, a variety of researchers in Boston, that showed that really the visual interaction, eye to eye, looking away, preoccupied mothers have a faulty ability to nurture the infants, which we knew from before. Pediatricians have always known that, but now there is some research for that.
So one of the questions that came up as we were looking at both of your work, and Yael, perhaps this goes to you first, there seems to be variation between siblings. So same parents, same experiences, variation among siblings. How do we account for this?
Somewhat. Every child actually grows up in a different family constellation. If you think of it, the first child is one plus two parents. So the issue is not just a matter of the birth order, but that every child is in a different milieu. And every child is born at different times of the parent's life, be it very soon after the trauma or later on. We used to think that the oldest ones would be the ones most affected. Our studies, however, shown that actually it's the youngest ones. So, first of all, every child has a different family constellation and therefore a different biopsychosocial milieu where they adapt to life and learn how to live. And at different times in life, parents behave differently. For example, survivor mothers who during the camp stopped menstruating, which was most often, were not even sure that they could give birth. Great stress and hunger might create that, not just in Holocaust survivors, but in other catastrophic events survivors. So the mere fact of giving birth became, or getting pregnant, or giving birth might have been felt like a miracle. Later on, it might feel differently. Now, I do want to elaborate on the differing adaptational styles in the parents. May I?
Please.
So in the victim style, that would be characterized by a feeling that the child has about the parents, as if the parent is stuck in the loss and the trauma rupture, that the parent is overprotective, and that the parent's emotionality is volatile. So you see both emotional volatility and control. And I use the word parent here advisedly, because until now, most of the implications were about the mother. And as I explained before, we tested both the children's perception of both fathers and mothers and found independent contributions to the child upbringing and adjustment. Then we have the numb style that I mentioned. In those families, you find emotional isolation and detachment, intolerance for weakness, if anything was threatening, both happiness and catastrophe. These are the families where there was a conspiracy of silence in the family. The child didn't know the history. I used to have in my office, at the entrance to my office, whatever cannot be talked about can also not be put to rest. And indeed, if there is no talking, the wounds would continue to fester from generation to generation, and the numb style shows that very clearly. Then we saw the different type of families, which we call the fighter style, where there is a great deal of valuing mastery and justice, or valuing Jewish identity among Jews, or valuing their own group identity. Now, when you refer to pathological reactions in the children, when the children do develop emotional and psychological maladjustments, you actually see the influence primarily of the victim style and of the mom style. It seems that the fighter style has no influence one way or the other, interestingly enough. So stereotypically, people used to think that when I describe these styles, they used to think, oh, the fighter style will contribute to health or to well-being. Well, we found out that the fighter style doesn't contribute one way or the other, interestingly enough. But it's those who grow up in homes that are of the victim style and the numb style that are most affected, that seem to develop the highest reparative adaptational impact. And I want to give you some more detail about the reparative adaptational impact. First, we find in the children what we call reparative protectiveness. The children protect the parents and protect each other. And that's the highest factor. We also find what I described before and what Andre described, the insecurity about their competence of meeting the world and performing in the world. You also find among the children, again, it's a matter of intensity. So not every child is the same, different intensities. We also find defensive psychosocial constriction, watchfulness. And the children who develop it, they develop watchfulness about others. They also share with the parents they need for power and control, both of themselves and of others. These are the children who would be obsessed with the Holocaust. Everything would be Holocaust, similar to the victim style, remember, in the parents. And we also see among those who develop high-intensity reparative adaptational impact, immature dependency. They would let the parents do for them what they can actually do for themselves for no reason that reality dictates. So I wanted to give you some more examples. I wanted to give more of the picture of it, how the child position him or herself vis-a-vis the world of ideas, the world of work, love relationship, social, etc. We found many differences. We even found differences among children of survivors who live in Israel and those who live in North America. Those who live in Israel, even if they were less wealthy, let's say, or less financially successful, their counterparts here live with a more fulfilling sense of meaning and connectedness. After all, trauma is a rupture. So what helps resurrect the sense of continuity and connectedness would be healing. And you find that the existence of a homeland, a land that you experience as home from before and forever, gives a sense of not only security, but healing, a sense of place and sense of meaning, which is very important. So, for example, today, with the world where we have over 68 billion refugees, you want to always do your studies both in the homeland and outside in the diaspora, because they might very well be different. We can't quite generalize. The more we learn, the more we understand that we cannot just generalize. We cannot just say simplistic statements and feel satisfied.
These manifestations, whether psychological or physical, particularly the negative ones, the maladaptive ones that you mentioned, the PTSD, the deep depression, if these are, you know, more or less static, particularly if they're biological. And perhaps this is a question for Andrei Novak, too, given the work you have been doing with the physical aspects. If it is indeed integrated physically, is there a pathway of healing?
Well, there are actually at least two questions that we ask. The first question that I sensed was whether there is anything static about intergenerational transmission. And no, it is not static. It is a moving target. And that's why it is sometimes difficult for many people to understand that there are great variability between people in terms of outcome, manifestations, and also life in general. Remember, just a parenthesis, that outcome has to do with an interaction in the family between children and their parents. Varies from child to child, of course. Different kids means different times in parents' life, which they may be totally different even though they have the underlying trauma, but they cope with that differently. And then there are the children that each child at birth may be a different temperament. There is a component, you know, it's a different person. While they are, you know, immature when they are born, but we know from studies of infants that different kids, different children have different temperaments. So you have different interactions. Some children that are more demanding will challenge the parents more and will bring out sometimes both positives, maybe more caring, but very often it makes parents regress to a point where they become actually more symptomatic and more needy themselves. So that may become a problem. And that may vary from child to child. So I think that that's one component. The other part that you mentioned, the physical is something that, first of all, we should not draw a distinction, or there's a continuity between the physical and the psychological and the mental. They all happen basically at the same time. We know now from a lot of work with the vagal system, the autonomic nervous system, that certainly the cortex and different cortical functions, including exposure to parents, behavior, whatever we incorporate, early experiences, are manifested in the autonomic reactions and then are learned or acquired in patterns. So certainly it becomes a physical write in, like written in, and that is very important. So there's no surprise that some of the traumatized kids that come from traumatized parents later have somatic symptoms, some of them. Well, in others it doesn't happen because they just don't have the intensity of the exposure to affect their entire neural, endocrine, and physical body. As you can see, there's a large variability that at very intense or very high levels of exposure, I would call them, you can certainly have the body be affected and in the long run have physical immunological problems that have been now demonstrated. The immune system is very sensitive in terms of interactions, early interactions, and it becomes programmed early in life. So the body is being rewritten according to trauma in many of the intergenerational families. The short answer to your question is yes, there is a lot of physical participation. Is it always the case? No, sometimes it is. And sometimes, as we have seen, these physical reactions can be actually an impetus for success in life. We've seen a lot of times individuals that come from traumatized families that are anxious by nature, have always been, but somehow that served as an impetus to become extremely successful in a new, sort of neurotic way, but still it makes them function well. So the outcome, the variability of outcome is tremendous in this case.
May I add here?
Please do, Yael Danieli.
Because I think the audience will share the myth with you about thinking that if they are physical manifestations or biological manifestations, they are far more stable than psychological manifestations. This is simply not the case. These are different dimensions where the trauma entered the system. Psychotherapy might very well help with the physical manifestations as well. I haven't had a patient who came in with all kinds of allergies and lived with them, for example, and many other manifestations. It is simply not true that what shows itself in the body is more stable or more stuck than in the heart, in the mind, in the soul. And it's really important to understand that. What we are finding are manifestations on different dimensions of the organism.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. And there is work now that has shown that, for instance, the immune system has a very important representation in the meningeal area of the brain, which is extremely sensitive to social and interpersonal interactions. So very often you modify the immune system with interactions, and social interaction is a very evolutionary valuable. So psychotherapy is based on a very evolutionary valuable process, which is interactive. Obviously, what we know is that very trauma can result in very treatment-resistant or very severe symptoms of PTSD. But in those cases, too, we have physical and psychological always in parallel. And when something is very resistant, it just takes much more work. But when they respond in group. You know, you see an entire improvement in the entire functionality of the body and the brain.
Right. Also, let me add again, so the listeners do not fall into another myth. We found that independent of the parents' diagnostic category, in the children, the highest manifestation of psychopathology was that of generalized anxiety disorder, number one. Number two is of depression. PTSD was the lowest in the children. I don't like to say only 14% because there's not an only. Any percent is too high and too tragic. But it's important to not assume a one-to-one correlation between the parents' psychopathology and the child's psychopathology. Exactly. That, too, we found not to be true. It sort of makes sense because generalized anxiety disorder really expresses that sense of the world is a dangerous place. You're fearful all around. PTSD might become much more specific. That's another myth we don't want the listeners to walk away with.
Right. Yeah, Andrei Novak, it sounded like you had a contribution to that.
Yeah, I wanted to add, this takes us back many years ago, and Yael probably remembers when we used to present probably 20 years ago. We knew at that time that PTSD is never transmitted intergenerationally. But trauma is. I mean, trauma, the fact that the legacy of trauma. Now, it's important about generalized anxiety because generalized anxiety is an evolutionary adaptive condition. It's survival. Mm-hmm. And so what it is actually, what is generalized anxiety in terms of the nervous system? It's a lower threshold of response to external stimulation, which sometimes results in feelings of anxiety, which is a signal, or sometimes doesn't, just feelings of palpitations and reactivity and being scrutinizing the environment. So it is a lower threshold of response, which is adaptational and makes sense to be present. Now, that being said, there is an important issue here from the point of view of psychopathology, what we know from psychiatry, that people who have generalized anxiety in general are more likely, 40%, to develop other psychiatric disorders in the long run. That makes us, of course, including PTSD, of course, one of the risk factors of PTSD. If a person like this goes to war, there's a risk factor that that person will develop PTSD. And that explains the findings of Zahava Solomon early, you know, in the 90s, where she found that Israeli soldiers who went to war and developed PTSD, the ones who were children of survivors, were more likely to take longer to recover. So that may explain exactly that hyperarousal that the transmission of trauma causes.
And final thoughts, concluding thoughts, Yael, Daniele, what would you add?
I would like to add that we have now developed for the first time psychological behavioral objective measure for multigenerational legacies of trauma that is now already translated into over 20 languages and is being studied not only among children of survivors of the Holocaust, but is adapted to grandchildren and also is being studied by many differing populations who underwent extreme massive trauma, such as the Armenians, such as the Cambodians, Rwandans, etc. And as I said, one of the recommendations we always have because of our cross-cultural findings is that when you study a traumatized population, it's good to study it both where they live now, perhaps with the history of being a refugee, but also in the homeland, because we found significant differences. We also, after all these years and after, you know, I published the International Handbook for Multigenerational Legacies of Trauma 21 years ago. It was one of the great papers for that book. We go back a long way. After all these years, we finally built the International Center for the Study, Prevention, and Treatment of Multigenerational Legacies of Trauma that awards excellence in research, but also, for example, in playwriting, in films, in novels that conveys the multigenerational trauma in the best way, but also give grants to researchers. And it is multidisciplinary and it is multidimensional. And it's important that people know about it and know it as a major resource. The headquarters are in New York.
And final thoughts, what would you like to add, Andre?
Well, my thoughts would be on a more global basis. I'm very preoccupied by current international and national political changes in attitude. And what I would like to just reiterate, that the work in intergenerational transmission of trauma says something. And it teaches us, first of all, that in families of traumatized people, there is a narrative of trauma that persists. We also learn that this narrative of trauma can make sometimes victims become victimizers, hence a cycle of trauma that has been talked about a lot. But I'm very concerned that what we are seeing right now, internationally and nationally, millions and millions and billions of refugees around the world, traumatized families being separated, even here at our, you know, at our southern border, things happening, is something that may create a negative legacy about this world for the future. And I'm very concerned that all the work in trauma that we have done and all the teaching and the education very often is ignored, not always, but very often is ignored by political leaders.
May I add to that? Because I'm 100% with Andre on this, and I passionately feel that decision makers must understand that the results of immediate decisions might carry on not only within one generation, but from generation to generation, and that they must remember it when they make their decision. It's a true imbalance between political lives that are normally, well, I don't know what's normal anymore, but that are in democracies for 8 years, and the person is preoccupied with maintaining their position and make decisions to affect that without perhaps really keeping in mind and being mindful of how long the effects of the decisions will remain.
I hate to be pessimistic about this, but many in our current leadership globally, I don't think have the capacity to think beyond the immediate, I'm sorry to say. I'm not saying that's universal. I'm just saying that if you watch them close up, it does not seem that there's much thinking going on in terms of effects at all.
Right.
I've been more preoccupied now looking at the relationship between individual narratives and social narratives. And I think that one issue that we might look at one point is, do democracies have an inbuilt mechanism to think about long-term consequences of this kind? I think this is a global failure of democracies. I mean, democracies are very important, you know, but I think that there is something that has remained behind, and that is looking at the well-being, psychological well-being of people in the long run.
Well, that is a perfect place to end. I think I would like to thank you both for joining us here on the Scholar's Circle, for sharing your research, for sharing your wisdom with us and our listeners, Andrei Novak and Yael Danieli. It's been a great pleasure to host you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Andrei Novak is clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine and the founding director of the Traumatic Stress Program. He's the author of Traumatic Stress in Human Behavior, Special Treatment Issues in Children of Holocaust Survivors, and Free Artistic Expression, a clinical exploration of resiliency and healing after trauma. Yael Danieli is director of the Group Project for Holocaust Survivors and Their Children. She's the founding co-president of the International Network of Holocaust and Genocide Survivors and Their Friends, and a founding director of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies. She's the author of publications including International Handbook of Multigenerational Legacies of Trauma, International Responses to Traumatic Stress, and research papers, Multigenerational Legacies of Trauma, Modeling the What and How of Transmission and Differing Adaptational Styles in Families of Survivors of the Holocaust. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.